Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we are chatting with Alex Tilley. He is with SecureWorks in Australia these days, but before that, he spent a big chunk of his career with the Australian Federal Police. Alex did a presentation a few weeks back at the AusCert conference on the Gold Coast, all about what fraud crews are up to these days. And he'll be joining us this week to walk through how much damage West African crime groups are doing with compromised Office 365 accounts. We also talk a bit about trends in money muling, because that game has really changed. This week's show is brought to you by Cylance, C-Y-L-A-N-C-E, the AV company. And in this week's sponsor interview, we'll be chatting with Cylance's very own Jim Walter about how ransomware hasn't really gone anywhere, despite most of the tech press getting sick of writing about it. There's still even growth in ransomware, and the pace of that growth has slowed a little bit. But with everyone reporting on coin miners these days, instead of ransomware, you'd be forgiven for thinking that it just disappeared. All of that is coming up soon, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, as expected, federal prosecutors have laid charges against this guy, Joshua Adam Schultz, who is apparently the source of the Vault 7 dump that appeared on WikiLeaks. These are the CIA, hacking tools, if you want to call them that.
Yes, apparently he worked in the engineering group at the CIA developing some of the stuff, and was originally fingered for investigation because he was the only person who'd left under bad circumstances. So, you know, I guess that's points for the CIA's HR policies.
Well, I was just thinking exactly the same thing. We've identified our sole disgruntled employee. I mean, they must have a great office, you know, pool tables, and, bean bags. I don't know.
I guess so, yeah. So, no, that's pretty funny. The reporting has also been saying that apparently he kept his kiddie porn in like encrypted containers, and the cops managed to decrypt three whole levels of encryption through password reuse from his cell phone.
So yeah, I remember we covered that at the time, right? Because he'd already been arrested, and we suspected that there was going to be a fresh indictment, and it's dropped, you know, and he's in trouble. You would think.
Yeah, no, he's going to have a bad time of it, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to do a leak because of politics. It's another thing to do it because just you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't imagine he's going to get much sympathy in any way compared to, you know, at least with, some of the leakers that have had motives, you know, Snowden or Manning. You're right, there are people who feel that their motives were justified in this case. Like, what are you doing, guy?
Yeah, and, you know, we've got to keep in mind, too, that some of these, some of these toolkits that were, you know, CIA toolkits, they were things that would turn on cameras in smart TVs and things, and they required physical access, which means, you know, human people actually with access to these things, loading these rootkits. And you'd imagine that after the Vault 7 stuff appeared, that some people may have discovered that their stuff was owned this way, and there would be investigations and maybe some sources. There was definitely potential for people to be killed over that leak as well. So good luck to you, Joshua, in prison. Anyway, moving on, the US Senate has rejected Donald Trump's plan to do a fabulous deal, a huge deal with ZTE to stop this export ban. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah, no, the deal as proposed, which was what, to like fire everybody ahead of ZTE and have them pay $1 billion more than they previously paid and a bond of $400 million for their good behavior. Yes, that's been thrown out through tacking it on the end of like a defense appropriations, like funding bill.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, nice. You know, yeah, American politics, man. Like every time there's always some, you know, bridge tacked onto a bill about pork in Iowa. And this, yeah, like tacking this onto a military funding bill. I mean, I guess job done, right? It worked. So, you know, you can't argue with that.
Well, I think now that bill needs to be reconciled with the House of Reps version and then go through Congress. But it just does not look like he's going to manage to do this, despite the $500 million loan the Chinese government made to a project he's involved in Indonesia.
Well, yeah, that's the people would be certainly making mileage out of that one, like that people perhaps shouldn't crow so much about their bribery on the Twitters. But hey, why not?
We've got some late breaking news here from Reuters just crossed my desk this morning, which is what they're calling a China-based campaign has been hitting a lot of defense contractors, telcos, and satellite operators as well.
Yeah, there's not very many details yet. Symantec apparently is gearing up to talk about it. But yeah, there's been some APT campaign that's been compromising defense contractors. And yes, operators, ground stations for satellites. There's some suggestion that it's involved with, you know, using that to intercept satellite comms. But there didn't seem to be any actual details that kind of substantiated that. Like, that may have just been some kind of, you know, dot connecting by, you know, by the reporter or by Symantec's PR people. I'm not quite sure yet. We'll have to wait and see the full details. But obviously, yeah, if you work in that kind of field, I imagine this is pretty much situation normal that everyone wants into your things all the time.
Back to the US Senate, and a bill has apparently been introduced, which is all about supply chain risks. And Kaspersky is mentioned, not surprisingly.
Yeah, this is a bill that I guess aims to kind of unify supply chain choices and to include the intelligence community in those decisions relatively early to try and stave off the sort of mess that they're dealing with at the moment with, you know, Kaspersky and I'm imagining Huawei and ZTE stuff as well, where, you know, all the different government departments are making their own procurement choices without really a lot of centralized direction. And then when you want to, say, go turn off everyone's Kaspersky, like, who knows where it is. And so, yeah, trying to bring some sense to this, whether it's possible to bring sense to government, you know, procurement and supply chains, I don't know. But they're trying, which is
good.
I'm
pretty sure, you know, it's funny, but I'm pretty sure Russia does this, actually. You have to get like an FSB, you know, import license to actually sell stuff there, I think, to certain places, which is, you know, pretty, it seems like sensible policy.
It does kind of seem rather sensible, doesn't it? But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess all of the West is kind of struggling with, you know, being open, freewheeling capitalists and then also having some kind of national interest in this. You know, I know the, you know, Australia versus Huawei gear in, you know, in your national networks. And we've had similar, you know, directives over here regarding
that's all, the that's use all of, kicked up again, by the way, over here, because Huawei is looking, it looks like Huawei is going to get locked out of our 5G build. And, you know, there's all a lot of talking heads jumping up and down on that one.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny over here because, I mean, the only people who've ever committed a terrorist act in New Zealand was the French and who runs a bunch of our stuff. Well, it's all Alcatel-Lucent under the hood, right? So yeah, maybe we should just buy some more Huawei.
You know, we spoke about that bank. I think it was in Colombia. No, Chile. That's right. It was in Chile. The Swift attack against that bank in Chile. That was, you know, surprise, surprise. That was Lazarus Group. The North Koreans done it. I mean, I didn't even think that needed to be said when we spoke about that, but I got a message from someone shortly afterwards saying, oh, you know, we think that was Lazarus Group. It's like, well, yeah, that's who does the Swift attacks.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a whole kind of flurry of South American, Central American banks.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't just
getting
Chile.
Their Swifts owned. We've seen other ones in, you know, more than one in Chile, you know, some in Mexico, all that kind of thing. The reporting so far says something like 15 million US has been lifted. The attribution to Lazarus is partially because they've been RMing the boxes afterwards to kind of, you know, get rid of the logs, which, hey, you know, I
guess logs, no crime. No logs, no crime.
Yes, cry of black hats everywhere, but yeah, real money being nicked, although not obviously of the same order of magnitude as old mate in Bangladesh, but 15 million is still good money.
Yeah, it buys Kim Jong-un a few bottles of Cristal and some solid gold Rolexes, that's for sure. And look, staying on North Korea, you know, the US government has actually issued a warning, DHS has issued a warning on some North Korean malware. I mean, they're still pretty active considering they're supposedly playing nice with America now.
Yeah, there was a report from the Department of Homeland Security and FBI released about a particular set of North Korean tools called Typeframe, apparently. You know, the average sort of thing, Windows malware and you know, Windows macros and you know, kind of remote control software after that. But yeah, I guess they're not really ramping it down, or at least I guess it's probably been in the pipe for a while, and maybe the timing is just unfortunate and the DHS didn't really anticipate that he'd show up for a summit and we'd all be friends this week, but no.
The crew behind Olympic Destroyer, which were probably probably the Russians pretending to be the Chinese pretending to be the North Koreans, they're back, apparently.
There's been reports of a campaign that's going after like chemical testing companies, which, you know, seems a little bit weird. But it turned out, well, someone has suggested that the link there is that one of the companies targeted is involved with the testing of the Skripals that got poisoned by the Russians in the UK. So that's, you know, that's plausible, I guess. I mean, certainly this whole, you know, the Olympic Destroyer thing and the attribution around that was, you know, very much about muddying the waters. So I'm not sure what's quite going on here either. But hey, something's going on. We know that much.
Yeah, well, as I wrote on Twitter, the circle is complete now that we've got Eugene Kaspersky talking about Olympic Destroyer's so-called deception efforts. He says, and I'm quoting here, those efforts changed the attribution game forever. It is no longer possible to draw conclusions based on a few attribution vectors. To resist such threats, we need better cooperation between private sector and governments across national borders. Now, this is just... I'm just going to be super cynical here and say that, you know, a statement like that serves Russia's agenda very, very well, because the whole point of Olympic Destroyer was so that statements like that could propagate, right? The whole point of those misattribution cues in the malware was to throw shade at attribution more generally. And it's, it's working.
Yeah.
You know, it's all fake news. You know, you don't know it was Russia. It could have been a 400-pound teenager pretending to be the Chinese, pretending to be Russia, you know?
Yeah, no, and Emma, it's a very valid point. I mean, of course, on the other hand, we do see attributions made shakily, but that's
but not by anyone that matters, and they don't last. Like even Olympic Destroyer, we knew like after like 2 days, like it was pretty clear that it was you know, someone was playing funny buggers.
Yeah, you know, and I guess that's where I was about to go, which is that, you know, we do see shonky attributions, but when it matters, we don't get to see the details generally out here in the open world because we own the IP cameras in the FSB building, we watch them do it, right? That kind of attribution, like the good stuff, we don't ever get to see. So we're left with, you know, the kind of cast off rubbish hand-me-down attributions based on, you know, EXE compile times or whatever other, you know, other stuff that everyone knows how to forge. So
I just love that stuff like that CCTV example leaks because it's just too good not to leak to someone.
Well, it is, right?
Like, well, after that ops wrapped up, you're like, who cares? We got to leak this. It's too cool.
Yeah. Well, and also because, I mean, there's so many people talking smack about attribution and sometimes, you know, you want to convince people that, hey, actually, we kind of do know what's going on. And, you know, yeah, as you say, it's too cool not to leak that.
Now we're going to turn our attention to some good old-fashioned security drama, Adam.
Yes. There was certainly some drama on the InfoSec Twitters recently. A few listeners may recall a few months ago we talked about, I think it was Michele and Marcus Verviers work on hijacking USB tokens via the web USB bindings in Chrome. So you could talk directly to USB-connected tokens and use that to, you know, get around or fish multi-factor auth. Anyway, they did that work. Something happened. Either they kind of communicated with Yubico or Yubico asked them about the specifics of it. Anyway, net result was Yubico had actually done some other work around this class of bugs, decided that the only place it needed to be fixed was in the browser. They reported it to Google. Google awarded them a bug bounty, Yubico, and then, InfoSec Twitter decided that Yubico had unfairly submitted the claims of, you know, the work of Michele and
Michele and Marcus were not exactly happy about it if you look at their Twitter feed. So they were saying, oh, they snagged our bounty and all this stuff. And they had actually reported this to Google and just never heard anything back, right? So Yubico sort of took the work, you know, asked them for source, asked them for details. By the looks of things, they broadened it a little bit and then reported it. But, you know, I've got to disclose too, like, first of all, Michele is a guy who I know and really like. He's cool dude. I think we mentioned that last time when we spoke about the research. Second of all, Yubico is actually a sponsor of this show, like minor sponsor. We've got some stuff coming up, so just so that that's all disclosed. But this looks like a classic case of just, you know, a mix-up, communication gone wrong. I don't think Yubico were like trying to steal their $5,000 bounty, but they probably should have paid a bit more attention to giving credit where it was due. They've since apologized too, to their credit.
Yes, yeah, Yubico have updated their blog post and advisory to say, hey, we should have given these guys more credit, and it wasn't entirely clear. And the timeline is a little bit muddy. Like, it seemed like they were talking to Google, right about the same time that Michele and Marcus did their talk at a con, you know, kind of disclosing the bugs and stuff. So, yeah, it all got a bit murky. It doesn't look to me as an outsider that there was any bad faith involved. And actually, as it turned out, Yubico had already donated that bug bounty to a good cause, and Google had matched it as well. So, I mean, it wasn't like they were, you know, pocketing the money and, you know.
Spending it on, you know, cigars or something. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I think, you know, really, I mean, if we were there in person with Marcus and Michele and, you know, Yubico would say, okay, now everybody shake hands.
Yeah, pretty much. Everyone just go, you know, go buy each other a beer, hug it out.
And yeah, hug it out, man. It's not worth the raised pulse. Like, let's put it that way, hey. Oh, now look, we had Colin Mulliner on the show some time ago. I think, oh God, I can't even remember if it was this year or last, but he was talking about the use of Telegram in Iran and just how popular it is. It's sort of like WhatsApp is in Brazil, just like everybody uses it. We've got a great story here from Lily Hay Newman at Wired talking about the fallout of Iran's Telegram ban, because they have banned it. What's really interesting about this is Colin at the time said the government wouldn't want to ban Telegram because there would be political fallout. And the way that it's worked out is it wasn't the government who banned Telegram, it was actually the courts, and the government has opposed it. So if you want to read something about the politics of messaging apps and, you know, bans, like this is a fantastic story.
Yeah, no, it is. It adds a kind of a bunch of details about the, you know, about what it means politically and domestically in Iran that, you know, from the outside isn't necessarily obvious. I mean, things like the, you know, the people who really experience you know, the censorship and the restrictions in Iran were, you know, people who were not really supporters of the, you know, of the political regime. And now, you know, with 40 million people using it for business and everything, and there's lots of people who previously weren't really affected who've now been drawn into this and kind of understand now better what it means to have your access restricted. So it's had, you know, sort of a bunch of side effects, you know, in terms of popular support for this kind of stuff that, you know, I guess.
I think the TLDR is it's pissed off people something shocking.
Well, yeah, exactly right. And that, you know, I mean, there's one of the quotes in the article is an interview with someone who works in the government, and we were using this to communicate, you know, our reports and stuff, like, because everything else was unreliable and you know, and complicated, and we were just using Telegram, and now we can't communicate with our superiors in the government department.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a quote in there saying basically that, you know, for a lot of Iranians, Telegram is the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, in much the same way that, you know, Facebook is the internet for some people, where we are. Yeah,
poor people.
You get
that, poor people.
I know, right?
Facebook is the internet. Oh, God. We got some more drama here. Look, now, I'd sort of resisted speaking about this when, you know, Paul Manafort, who is, you know, was Donald Trump's former campaign advisor, he'd thought he was being clever using Signal and WhatsApp and whatnot to communicate with possible witnesses, which is why he's now in prison. It looks like some WhatsApp and Signal data stored on Michael Cohen's BlackBerry. Michael Cohen, of course, being Trump's personal lawyer. You know, they've intercepted a whole bunch, 731 pages of messages from WhatsApp and Signal intercepted from his BlackBerry. This is just an interesting case where, you know, we're not talking about activists here. We're talking about powerful people who are alleged to have done some pretty naughty stuff, who are being given up by their messages. And I just think this is the sort of case that I think of when everyone's like, we need to make communications impervious to law enforcement. I'm like, yeah. Then you're putting dangerous criminals like Paul Manafort back on the street.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Cohen. Yeah, and also it really illustrates the importance of the trade-off between, you know, what you get from transport crypto and what you get from REST crypto and what you get from the key management of your REST crypto, and which of these things is kind of more important in a way.
But yeah, like this Michael Cohen story, is there anything actually interesting here, or is it just about what you'd expect?
It seems to be about what you'd expect. They obviously got images or obtained access to his phone, and obviously it took a while for them to dig through, identify all the things on there, identify that there were stored messages in the, you know, the containers, the encrypted containers that the messaging apps use, and then they had to go through the process of extracting those, you know, using the key material on the device, which is just, you know, takes a little time to get through in a, you know, evidentially robust way.
I'm just impressed Signal has a build that runs on BlackBerry. You know, for all of the 20 people who use it. Yeah, I mean, it says
fake Android BlackBerries.
Maybe it is. I don't know. Oh, this story also from Ars seems like a bit of a nothing burger, actually, which is macOS will, like, if you load an external encrypted volume and you, like, preview files from it, like, the icon that you used when you were, like, previewing these files gets cached on your local file system, which, you know, they're saying is like an OPSEC risk. But if you've got full disk crypto on your main drive, I don't see how this is an issue. Or am I missing something here?
No, I don't think you're missing something. It's really not a huge story. I mean, you know, thumbnails being stored places is absolutely a thing that forensics examiners do look for. And I think, you know, exposing file names and contents of files that were on encrypted disks that either they don't have access to, or they're looking for probable cause to compel you to, you know, hand over keys to, it might be useful there. But this is like super niche, and I don't think is really worth a, you know, worth a write-up on the front page.
The media, it appears, has brought about a positive change. All of those stories about like Verizon and AT&T and all the US carriers selling real-time access to their subscribers' locations to like marketing firms that were then, you know, in turn passing that on to law enforcement. Verizon and AT&T have announced they're going to stop selling that location data, which, I mean, I just wonder how on earth they thought that that was a good idea in the first place.
Well, I mean, clearly it's not, but they had a bunch of there's some details actually in these stories about the sorts of contractual controls they thought they had. Like, for example, I think it was AT&T required the brokers it was selling the data to obtain consent from the individual users. In the case of the prison service, you know, kind of like number lookup thing, apparently they were supposed to play the recipient of the call from the prison an IVR message that said, "Do you consent to having your location looked up as part of monitoring of this call," which of course they weren't doing. But yeah, that's, I guess that's the weaseling that the carriers were using, was that, oh, we had controls on there and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, at least following all of this, yeah, we've seen Verizon, AT&T, and actually also Sprint now saying that A, they've cut off the particular brokers in question, and B, that they're, you know, reviewing or whatever the other people that they share it to willy-nilly.
Yeah, well, I mean, my favorite weaseling in this one, there's an update on the story saying that T-Mobile CEO John Legere, not sure, he wrote on Twitter that his company will not sell customer data, location data, to shady middlemen, but then, of course, does not define what he considers a shady middleman to be, which is nice job there, guy. Now, we just love seeing horrible stuff get into app stores, and Docker Hub, not immune. 17 backdoor Docker images have been removed.
And the thing that's great about this story is like, what, you mean only 17? That's ridiculous. You know, obviously,
well, 17 that they found this time, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not sure that people, you know, that a lot of people who use Docker necessarily realize that they are just downloading random images uploaded by who knows who to, you know, Docker Hub or anywhere else you're getting them from. And so, yeah, I mean, the idea that people were pre-backdooring images, or in this case, some of them were running, you know, like crypto miners out of the box, is, you know, exactly per expectations.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's still, it's
so few.
Yeah, so few now, right? Let's see what we're talking about in a year. Now, Cortana, Microsoft's totally not Siri ripoff, is, man, like, bad bug in Cortana. Oh, it's been fixed now, but this is a shocker, right?
It's so good. This guy, Cedric Koshin from McAfee, he posted details of this really hilarious bug. So you're sitting on the lock screen of your Intune box with Cortana. In this case, he plugs a USB stick in with a PowerShell script that, you know, shells the box. And then basically he starts talking to Cortana. And then in the kind of like window where you can start typing to help Cortana, you know, give it more specifics, or you know, make more specific entries for your query, he just starts typing file names, and then it uses the search indexing or whatever, and then you can just kind of like right click run straight from the login box, which is pretty hilarious.
So you can run your PowerShell scripts on your USB device.
In this case, run your PowerShell script that you know bypasses auth on the box, and yeah, job done.
Fantastic. Pretty dumb bug that one, and that's we got a story here too, staying with Microsoft. You know, an old technique is, you know, being used by phishing crews to bypass OU365 filters. I guess the reason this is interesting to me is, you know, since I've started doing like Snake Oilers and Soapbox, those, you know, vendor-centric podcasts, you know, I've learned a lot about the vendor landscape and who's doing stuff well and who's doing stuff like not so well. And I can tell you that Office 365 mail filtering is pretty rubbish, but this story really highlights how rubbish it is.
Yeah, this was a good example of using, you know, kind of characters that are when a message is being parsed by a machine, give it one idea of the content, and yet when rendered for display to a user, gives them another idea of the content. We've seen a bunch of this, you know, kind of canonicalization technique over the years. In this case, people are using like zero width characters that break up the words for the computer, but not for the human. There was another example where they were using, I think, like the base HTML tag to break up bits of a link. But yeah, good example of you know, those kind of generic bug classes. And yeah, people using them against O365 in the wild.
Hey, we got some cryptocurrency stuff here. Someone broke into a GitHub account for some sort of, you know, cryptocurrency client software and like Trojan the shit out of it. I mean, nice job, right?
Yeah, like put wallet stealing malware into the coin client. Sigh. Yeah.
There's another one too, which is like a clipboard hijacker that can identify like cryptocurrency material. They managed to get that one onto 300,000 machines.
Yeah, and it's funny because it monitors the clipboard, and anytime it sees a Bitcoin or you know other coin address going past, just like swaps in their own one.
Oh, is that what it does? So they're not stealing keys; they're just like swapping out addresses.
Yeah, so that particular one, yeah, it just swaps the addresses in the clipboard, which is
why
such
do we
a,
work?
It's so ghetto, but why on do the we other work hand, for a living? I bet they made real money.
Why do we work for a living? Oh, Adam, it looks like you know, Who Is Information, the great GDPR Mageddon of redacted Who Is. That's happening.
Yeah, no, it totally is. I Who Is the domain this very day and got redacted for privacy purposes in every possible field. So yeah, that sucked. Brian Krebs is right. It's totally happening.
Yep, it has happened. Oh, some people might remember that a while back we did a feature on, I can't remember if it was a feature or just news, but we spoke about this whole Tether coin propping up Bitcoin and possible fraud there, holding up the price and causing the skyrocketing values. It looks like there's been some academic research there that says, yeah, that's what's been happening. So I just want to mention that because, yeah, like I don't think the confirmation of that as a, or, you know, that theory having more credibility is going to be great for Bitcoin. So just something to consider if you are a hodler. And finally, Adam, this week's skateboarding dog is in fact an armed idiot.
Yes, this rather, I guess, tragic in a way, story concerns Sherman Hopkins Jr., 43, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who for some reason wanted to take over someone's domain name, some kind of, you know, like college people doing dumb things joke site. Anyway, decided he wanted to have do it for state. .com, I think it was, and rather than doing the regular sort of domain hijacking things, you know, sending some phishing emails, you know, maybe I don't know, maybe even blackmail would have been reasonable. No, he decided to just get a gun, look up the guy's address in the Who Is, because, you know, Who Is, privacy violation, look up the guy's address on Who Is, roll up to his house with a gun, let himself in, and then this. I mean, the story is hilarious and tragic at the same time. Anyway, he shows up with a printout of the instructions of how to transfer domains on GoDaddy, and then at gunpoint forces the guy to follow the instructions on the printout, log into his GoDaddy control panel, and transfer.
But then it goes full Hollywood.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing, right? So he's doing the domain transfer, and then he gets to the bit where he has to enter the name of like the address and the phone number of the person he's transferring it to, and the guy looks around to the gunman and is like, "Well, what am I going to put in the phone number field? What's your number, bro?" And the guy, of course, pistol whips him and a fight breaks out. He tases him as well for good luck. They struggle over the gun. The original domain owner gets shot in the leg, manages to wrestle the gun off the guy, and then shoots him 3 times in the chest.
But he survives, and now he's going to prison for 20 years.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's just, you know, like that's...
And I can't decide whether he's lucky or unlucky. You know what I mean? Like, because being shot 3 times and then surviving, but then going to prison. I mean, so much to unpack here, Adam.
I know, right? And then when he's in jail and, you know, everyone else is asking, like, what are you in for? You know, murder, what are you in for?
I tried to hijack a domain name.
Yeah, I tried to, jack a $20 a year domain name. And then I got shot 3 times. Like,
he did get shot 3 times, but he survived. You know, what you lose on the swings, you make up on the merry-go-rounds. Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. It's been a lot of fun, mate. Really enjoyed that, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, I look forward to it, but hopefully less people get shot next week.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. And we've got an announcement this week. DCSO, the German cybersecurity organization, is hiring for multiple positions to join them in Berlin and research, analyze, and produce intelligence for its German multinational clients. Open positions include malware analysts, back-end developers, and regional threat intelligence experts. DCSO is a private company founded by a group of German companies in order to maximize cybersecurity resources and support research. It prioritizes efficacy over immediate profits. Successful candidates will have an understanding of major actors and issues, strong analytical skills, but language skills and regional knowledge are an advantage. Further information is available at dcso.de, and interested parties should contact careers@dcso.de. And before we get into this week's feature interview, I just want to mention that I'm publishing a Snake Oilers podcast this week. I've got interviews with 5 vendors that I'll be rolling rolling out in two parts over the next couple of weeks. And I really, really want to encourage you all to listen to this edition. This week, I'll be publishing my interview with Rapid7, talking about its Insight IDR product. And that's a product I really, really like, just personally. And I'll be posting an interview with Stefan Schnett, also of Attack IQ, and they do attack simulation stuff. Now, I know most of you already do listen to Snake Oilers, but I'm really, really, really happy with the way this latest edition came together. And hand on heart, I think, you know, you'll really enjoy it. It is sponsored content, but vendors actually have stuff to say these days that isn't crackheaded, and hearing about what they're up to is actually pretty interesting. But anyway, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Alex Tilley. Alex is a really well-known and very well-liked guy in the Australian security scene. He worked for the AFP for a number of years as a cybercrime investigator before bouncing out to a job with SecureWorks as a senior security analyst. He did a fantastic talk at Auscert a few weeks back talking about some of these email-based scams targeting, like, you know, in this instance, home buyers. People's entire life savings are disappearing in these scams, and the victims are mostly finding themselves in a liability black hole. And the amounts of money involved have really changed the money muling game as well. So Alex joined me to talk through all of this the other day, and here's what he had to say.
It's email driven. So they've got to get access to an email box. Typically it's OWA or Office 365. So it's the mailbox of, let's say, a real estate agent. Once they get access to the real estate agent's mailbox, oftentimes what they'll do is they'll set up inbox rules, which no one ever checks, so no one ever sees it. And they'll start to intercept emails between, you know, vendors and clients and people selling and buying houses and that sort of stuff. Once they've, you know, found their victim through looking at things like the calendar, because obviously real estate deals go to a set schedule, they'll know exactly whose emails to grab and then what to expect in those. And then once they come through, they can rewrite them and change them to change, you know, say, hey, I'm going out of town, so I've got to change the destination of these funds. Or, you know, I've been called away sick, can we do this via wire transfer now instead of check? You know, all those sort of tricks just to sort of get a person to change the way they were going to do their transfer. And then obviously, you know, send the money on to them or their mule.
What I found really interesting about this is that they were actually working both sides of the conversation, right? So they were impersonating both people to each other. It's real man in the middle.
Yeah, it's awesome, and no one ever has a clue because both sides are getting what they expect out of the conversation.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah, it's not until you know, maybe a week or hell, a couple of days probably later, that one party will go, hey, where was that money you were going to transfer? And they'll go, well, I did transfer it. Here's the email from you with the details saying that you received it. And then the whole thing obviously gets blown up. And you can
well,
see what's happening.
And this is the thing, right? The bank is not part of the liability chain here because they can quite rightly argue that they just executed a transfer that they were asked to do by the client.
Exactly. They were acting on the instructions of the client. And obviously, yeah. if it's outside of a recoveries period, you know, people will be losing their life savings to this sort of stuff.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, I bought a house about 5 years ago and I went through the settlement process. And when it did come time to transfer my entire life savings as a deposit into the trust account of the real estate agent, I did actually pick up the phone and confirm the account number. Now, I'm guessing this is advice that you would want people to take pretty seriously. But beyond that, there is an obvious solution to this, and it's two-factor authentication, something as simple as that.
Yeah, definitely. And I did the exact same thing as you. I asked my real estate agent, hey, can I just call you to confirm? And she and my wife looked at me like I was crazy. And I was like, just trust me. I want to confirm this.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry. I'm paranoid. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. I just want to check. It'll take you 2 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. But definitely, like, the initial entry point to begin this entire chain is just a straight up, you know, Outlook with Access or Office 365. So yeah, two-factor kills this stone dead. It will at least force them to the next level, which is, you know, there's evolution in security, but let's, you know, let's be honest, at this state, they're having a lot of fun with, you know, people's real estate transactions now, and it's not going to stop.
Yeah. Now this is, we should point out too, this is the sort of lower skilled end of the threat landscape, shall we say. I mean, these are a lot of the people who are doing scams running out of Africa. Is that where a lot of this activity is emanating from, or is it sort of spreading around?
It's mostly West African based, definitely West African people traveling around the world. So you see a lot of them obviously with these indictments in the States who are living in the US, up in Malaysia, various places like that. So it's a natural evolution, if you will, of the old 419 scams and that sort of stuff. Now it's the same crew, right?
But I guess what's interesting about that is that, okay, two-factor authentication will only kill this dead for those groups. I mean, there are other groups that could use malware for similar effect and, you know, deeper penetrations of, you know, real estate companies' networks and whatnot. But, you know, I think you and I are both on the same page here when we say that, you know, if I say that, you know, 2FA will certainly make it not worth the while of these groups.
Oh, most definitely. They'll move on to the next easiest target. You know, they've sort of they've moved through maritime and then through construction and now into real estate. And as these industries wake up to these problems and start to, you know, do whatever steps they need to, these guys will just follow the money to the next thing. So they're not bound by any particular targeting. They're just bound by money. And wherever there's money and some sort of vulnerability, that's where they'll be.
Now, it's been all very well and good for us to have a chuckle about a lot of cybercrime in the past because it's generally been covered and absorbed. I mean, we all pay for it, right? Through increased rates with our bank or whatever it is. But there's that little, you know, bit of the fee that you pay to your bank in whatever transaction or whatever loan or whatever it is that covers the cost of fraud, right? So we all sort of bear it. And it's not a horror story when a large bank loses some money, right? Oh, well. This is different, isn't it? Because it is just such a liability black hole. Who is liable in this case? It's very hard to tell. I mean, you'd think maybe if it was a real estate agent's account that got popped, you know, maybe they bear some of the moral responsibility for making restitution, but they just might not be able to. Real estate agents aren't as cashed up as people think they are.
Yeah, definitely. And funnily enough, after I did my talk at Auscert on this, someone came up to me and showed me their current real estate contract. They're going through this process at the moment. And there was a clause at the bottom of it to the effect of, we don't have any liability if you get a bad electronic communication. I can't remember the exact wording of it.
Oh, but that's interesting. So they are aware of the problem, but this is their solution instead of two-factor auth.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was very interesting because it means, yeah, obviously they're aware that something's happening and they've got to take steps to fix it. But it's an ugly one because all of these types of tricks, be they romance scams or the 419s, this sort of stuff, they have human victims, as you're saying. It's actually people will lose out to these things.
Yeah, because I'm you know, you'll hear Adam and I laughing our asses off when some institution lost, you know, millions of dollars. We think it's terrific. But when it's, you know, when it's some normal person who's, you know, that money is their blood, sweat, and tears, it's a little bit different, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. And I think as an industry, we maybe don't want to think about this so much because it's not quite as neat as bits and bytes. It's, you know, tears.
Yeah, it is. And I do wonder, though, I mean, I think to a degree, you know, when you're dealing with, funnily enough, just going back to what you said about forwarding rules, I mean, that is something that Google Mail will do. If a new forwarding rule pops up on your inbox, it keeps a notification up there for a week, right? Because they're kind of onto this little bit. I sort of wonder, I don't know if Microsoft does this through, you know, Office 365, through Outlook, you know, online magic cloud Outlook, but you'd think they should, right? And you would think that if they don't, that there may be a little bit culpable. And it's my personal view that companies like Microsoft and Google need to do an awful lot more to encourage their users to use 2FA.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not sure, obviously, how these particular victims are set up each time. Yeah, and obviously, even if there was an alert, maybe someone just ignores it. You know, who knows with people involved, right? But definitely, there's an onus on those companies that provide these services to help their people not become victimized, to secure themselves by default. And that's simple things like two-factor, which, you know, it's even funny for me to say two-factor is a simple thing, but it is in 2018. Back it in the is. Day, it was not back in the day, but these days, yeah, it's pretty simple, straightforward.
Mm. And what's the scope of this problem though, Alex? Because it's, I mean, we've just seen these indictments, there's talk of millions of dollars and whatnot, but I mean, do we have much of an idea about what this as a crime industry is worth?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, I know the FBI put a number of, I think it was 5 billion on it a couple of years ago. But it's definitely like when you see individual criminal syndicates who are doing $5-10 million that is in the documents, that sort of is indicative that people are making a lot of money. And the other thing to be aware of is that criminals won't do crime unless it's making them money. So if the fact that it's getting worse and there's more people doing it and there's more industries being targeted means that there's a lot of money in there, and, you know, jump in the pool, the fraud's lovely. Mm. I think that, you know, globally, I don't think we'll ever really quantify it, but I know, you know, $600,000-$700,000 per victim is not unheard of with the construction industry ones. And as these filings have shown here, there's definitely millions of dollars to be made with one syndicate.
Yeah. Now, look, getting the money from one account to the other, I mean, that's almost the easy part, isn't it? Because then you've got to move on to the cash out phase, which used to be a real stumbling block for a lot of these people, right? Because they would transfer the money into, you know, sort of pool it into one account and then maybe try to get some sucker to Western Union it. You know, after Western Union's giant settlement for allowing this to go on for so long, that's no longer possible. I was really happy to see that that action taken against Western Union, by the way. That was fantastic. So how do they do it now? Because I watched your presentation and it's not the straightforward process of finding a few dummies just to wire stuff anymore. It's got a lot more complex.
It really has. And it's a function of the amount of money being made. So if we think back to, you know, when I was a little tacker starting out in banking, we're talking about frauds of $2,000 to $3,000. You know, the bad guys would keylog you or somehow get access to your little, you know, your standard retail banking account, make a transfer below your daily limit. And then they'd have that go to an unwitting mule. And
they'd screw you on payday and the bank would make it right.
Exactly. And these days, what's happened is through the use of, well, even if you think of the malware side of the fence, things like Dire and Drydex, those sort of those malware toolkits, they were targeting business banking platforms. They were targeting wealth management platforms. They were targeting, in some cases, share trading platforms. And what that means is when they get a hit, when the bad guys win, they're getting six figures now. So they need to have someone set up who can actually shift $400,000 to $500,000 quickly. And to do that, you can use what I like to call a well-matured or ripened romance scam victim, which is someone who's on the hook emotionally and will set up the business banking accounts and will transfer the money and can be relied on it. But what's more and more common is the criminal groups will send a known other criminal group out to, say, Australia. And they'll set up the business banking accounts, they'll set up the, you know, the international transfer rules, they'll get everything set up. And then they'll accept the one large transaction of a couple hundred thousand dollars. And then
Set up an account with a Forex broker. They'll actually have a legitimately registered company. I mean, you know, I do business with the United States. I kind of know how this is done.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd really just need to get it to a country where it can be withdrawn as cash. And then you can deposit it back into the system however you want, right?
Most definitely. And the problem is now that when the bad guys win, they win a lot more than they used to win. So it's in their best interest now to have a bit of effort to set up this infrastructure and to put people on planes and that sort of stuff. Because one payday is worth a lot more than it used to be. You know, if you lose out on $2,000, oh, well, I'll get another $2,000 tomorrow. You know, if you lose out on $500,000, you're going to be pretty upset.
Yeah. So it's actually worth sending those people in. But as you pointed out, that's a law enforcement opportunity when you've actually got people being dispatched to the country and you might already have some intelligence on them.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Like I've always said, and I know other people have said the same thing, but I've always said mules are where law enforcement wins the most. To affect the muling and to affect the cash pipeline of these bad guys, that's where law enforcement can really, really make a difference.
But they're not using spam recruited mules to do this anymore, are they? Because it's just the stakes are too high. You drop $500,000 into some rando's account and they're probably just going to take it to Bolivia.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why it's in their best interest to shift things out. And that's why, you know, understanding your local mule environment in Australia or in, you know, US or in the UK, wherever, that's where law enforcement can then start to press on those lower level mules to force the bad guys to send people into country, because that's where they can win.
Now, this truly is, you know, an international, like the international sort of online fraud business is, I mean, it's crazy the sort of circumstances that wind up popping up. I think my favorite one of my favorites was when the Yakuza wound up doing a massive cash out on Japanese ATMs using the stolen card details of South Africans.
Yeah, it was one of those situations where it's like something out of a movie, right? You have, you know, digital hacker with his hoodie on hacking card details in South Africa, and then, you know, the line on the globe goes across on the Pew Pew map and lands in Japan, and you have the Yakuza guys with their tattoos and machetes organizing, you know, like 100 mules or so. To then cash out, I think it's like $17 million in about 3 hours or 2 hours, something like that, like a crazy amount of money. And that is organized crime. I think any of your listeners who are, you know, in law enforcement or have worked in banking will know that to organize mules is like herding cats. So to be able to actually organize, you know, 100 or so mules to do this across 1,400 shops.
Yeah, trying to get 100 meth heads to do anything is pretty hard, right?
Exactly, right? It's phenomenal, and it really shows the organization. And, of course, then you have the situations with, you know, the Moldovan bagmen getting caught and the Russians skipping back to Russia. You know what I mean? So it sort of shows a really interesting way these things are definitely global and very, very quick. So I think that particular event That, and if you remember back to the RBS WorldPay event back in the day.
I sure do.
Yeah. So those things are showing this massive organization here. So when the bad guys win, they really, really win.
Oh, there was one thing I wanted to mention too before we go. You mentioned something about these attacks in the case of, you know, real estate agents and whatnot, that they wait for a while before they engage in any activity because they want to clear themselves from the rolling 30-day logs. Like, what are they trying to hide there?
Yeah, it's weird. I think they don't expect to get in. And when they do get in, they're like, oh, okay, I better turn my proxy on, or, you know, better turn my VPN on.
Oh, you're
on
kidding
now.
Me. That's why they're waiting 30 days, because they're exposing their real IPs.
Yeah. And then, of course, you see, then they just come back and they transfer it to an account in their own name. And it's like, well, okay, so you were scared of one thing, but not of another thing. But yeah, definitely. It's in my mind, is definitely a case of, whoops, I better turn the VPN on.
Yeah, right. Not the sharpest tools in the shed. Sharing a bit of OPSEC failure with Russia's GRU there.
Yeah. Interesting.
All right. Alex Tilley, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. And I will see you about the traps.
Cheers, mate.
That was Alex Tilley of SecureWorks there. Big thanks to him for that. This week's show is brought to you by Cylance, the antivirus company. Cylance, of course, did machine learning-based AV before it was cool, and they've become very much an established AV company. Jim Walter is a senior researcher with Cylance's Spear research team, and he joined me to talk about the mismatch between the public conversation around ransomware and the reality of what CISOs are actually dealing with. Despite all the headlines being about coin miners these days, Jim says ransomware is as prevalent as ever. So yeah, I mean, I started off by asking him if ransomware had dropped off, and here's what he said.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. I think there has been a lot of focus sort of shifted on coin miners and crypto mining and some of the, you know, the latest and greatest in terms of UAS spooky stuff. But yeah, at the detriment of some of the coverage for ransomware, which is still very much a threat and, you know, growing as ever.
Yeah, right. And have there been any sort of trends in ransomware over the last sort of 6 months? I mean, has it been trending up? Has it been trending down? Is it staying about the same? Because I think really what's happened is, to a large degree, the media just got sick of writing about it, and coin miners came along and they're like, hey, let's write about this instead.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely always kind of a new, more sort of sexy thing for things to be written about, and crypto mining and coin related crime has kind of taken that place. But it's not rising at the rate that it was maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, but it still definitely is on the rise. And the overarching theme has always been ease of entry. You know, if you want to, you know, become a cyber criminal and ransomware is your focus, it's easier than ever to get into that. You don't have to know how to code at all, you know, as we've seen with a lot of recent service offerings. And those services, which are, you know, usually require nothing out of pocket to, you know, kind of get going, are adding on more and more sophisticated capabilities, so that, you know, these entry level folks that are launching these campaigns can do more and more damage, and it becomes a much greater impact for lower barrier of entry.
Yeah, I think last time we spoke, we were really speaking about any old idiot being able to get in and run a campaign. I think the thing that makes ransomware, you know, it's a word that makes the skin of a lot of our listeners crawl, is because it's just so destructive, right? In a way that, like, it's just such a day ruiner for people who work on InfoSec teams, as opposed to coin miners, which is like, yeah, you remove them, but you don't have to spend usually a whole day, you know, doing a restore and like dealing with lost productivity and this and that. It's a much easier thing to bounce back from. So yeah, I mean, are we still seeing that people aren't using CVEs to drop these things? It's just really relying on users to install them?
Well, it's a whole lot of both. It's a lot easier for folks to include specific exploits. So we're seeing Eternal Blue get tacked on to a lot of stuff that, you know, where it wasn't available before, like the Satan ransomware, which has been a service for, you know, quite a while. You know, they now have the ability to use Eternal Blue, as well as some other exploits that are similar to the ones that SamSam and others target. So
I can't believe that Eternal Blue still works, by the way. That's just amazing.
You know, we still see the old Configer vulnerability being targeted. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that is, you know, from our biased perspective dealing with it every day, you know, it's old as dirt, but it's, you know, there are, as long as there's vulnerable systems, you're going to see people trying to hit it.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, still, if you plug in a, you know, you just plug a NIC onto the internet, you're probably still going to see a bit of code red.
if you wait long enough, right?
Absolutely.
Mm. So, you know, you've got your Eternal Blue and you actually do have a few people using exploits and whatnot, but I'm guessing the bulk of it is still email?
Oh, yeah. Email, drive-by downloads. Absolutely. Yeah. But email
what are we seeing with drive-by downloads? Because, you know, exploit kits have been dropping off. I mean, we saw a recent Internet Explorer zero day used by North Korea that wound up in an exploit kit, breathed a bit of new life into it. But on the whole, you don't hear much about them these days. Are you still seeing much drive-by activity? Because I guess Silence is in a good position to collect that sort of telemetry.
I would say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't necessarily have to utilize an exploit kit just to have something shared out there and accessible for endpoints to pull. You know, even if it's just a simple dumb file being hosted on a server somewhere to receive the click through traffic from a piece of spam, from that on up to the sophistication of exploit kits, we do still see it. So, you know, it just kind of depends on where you're looking.
So, look, I guess what you're saying here is that ransomware hasn't gone anywhere, and the advice really for people listening out there is going to be the same as it was a year ago. Maybe that's why people aren't talking about it anymore, is because it's a known quantity.
Well, absolutely, yeah. It just has become, you know, part of the daily course of your daily routine is, you know, which system do I need to blow away and reimage because of ransomware? You know, do I need to pay these guys or can I restore from known good backups? You know, whatever your recovery mechanism may be, you know, it's definitely still out there, and it is probably just something people have grown. Unfortunately, you know, there's a little bit of malaise around it, but it's by all means still a threat. You know, and they're just adopting new stuff as we said. You know, more and more simple services are using Eternal Blue. We're seeing them utilize blockchain DNS for command and control infrastructure, which is a little bit you know, more attractive in terms of it being decentralized and harder to sort of take down or seize. So, you know, it's evolving just as it ever, as it has been in the past. And, you know, it's definitely still a threat to be you know, considered serious.
I get really frustrated often when I'm reading about the way that people do exfil, you know, and C2, because it's usually something completely lame, like connecting to like a domain that can be blocked or something. And there's so many better options. I mean, even DNS is like not one of the amazing ones, but sure. Like, okay, that's at least showing some creativity, right?
Right. Yeah. But still, you know, whatever works, if they can get away with doing something in a very simplistic way, then they will. I mean, that's never changed. Even looking at something like the Target attack, you know, they were sending stuff out via FTP, you know, it was super duper loud and obvious to see. But, you know, whatever works, whatever's the quickest way to get the information out there.
It just annoys me. It's lazy. It's lazy. If you're going to do a job, do it right. Come on. Have some pride, people. So
would you like to see innovation?
That's right. So what else has been going on out there in malware land? I mean, you know, as we've just discovered, ransomware is still as much a threat as ever, even though, you know, crypto miners are getting all of the sort of attention. I mean, is it pretty much business as usual out there, Jim?
For the most part, yeah. You know, you mentioned the zero day that sort of popped up a few, I guess, month ago or so, the double kill stuff, you know, we're still seeing some, you know, little highlights and blips around, but, you know, beyond that, it's been fairly stable in terms of you know, stuff that kind of falls outside the norm for the last month or so, I would say.
I was surprised. I mean, we only spoke about that one, that bug on the show last week. I mean, I'd seen the news. I think we might have even reported on the fact that Microsoft had patched an IE zero day, you know, and, it wasn't until last week that I actually picked it up and looked at that bug, and it's I mean, I was just surprised at what a shocker it was, you know, affecting pretty much all Windows versions. So makes sense that it's going into an exploit kit, but I can't imagine they're getting too many successful compromises with that bug, considering that, you know, these days Windows hosts tend to auto patch pretty quickly. But, you know, again, you've got the telemetry. What are your chances of owning, you know, like a current generation Windows, like Windows 10, with a 2-month-old unpatched IE bug?
Well, the important thing you have to remember is there's still a lot of, you know, enterprise and large environments out there that can't embrace the streaming or immediate patching. They still have to test stuff internally. They have, you know, their own internal builds that have to be compatible with everything that comes out from all their vendors, including Microsoft for their OS. So not everyone can update immediately once you know, that patch is available. And the bad guys are often, when we see scenarios like this, the double kill scenario, you're seeing a very, for one thing, it's a very targeted scenario. And they may even know that there's a certain, gap in their target's patching cycle so that, when they hit at a certain time, it's guaranteed to work because they're not going to have patch XYZ installed yet. But even less sophisticated, you can generally kind of bet that certain things are going to work, if you send out a large enough scattering of traffic. So, I guess the short answer to your question is it's still pretty good. You still have a fairly good chance, especially when you consider the fact that not everyone can update immediately.
Yeah, I just would have thought, though, in this day and age, especially operating systems like Windows 10, hopefully that's getting less effective. God, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not to say things aren't getting better. Absolutely. Controls on the OS side, as well as people being more aware and more aggressive with patch cycles where they can. The situation is improving, but there is still a situation.
Is there any way for Silence to get telemetry on the use of bugs like that? Because I guess, if you're doing any sort of file origin tracking, like where did this file come from? I'm guessing if it's something that's trying to execute just out of the blue, you can kind of assume that maybe that one arrived via some sort of exploit. Is that sort of how you make that judgment?
Yeah, I mean, sort of speaking vaguely, we do have mechanisms where we can sort of step back a few steps within certain telemetry data and try to make determinations that, okay, it came through this host, through this vector, and it was likely this scenario. We do have some capability to do that. Part of it is and Silence isn't the only vendor in this boat. A lot of people have this sort of capability as a feature, yeah, of a product. How deep can we go in our analysis of any sort of event or artifact on an endpoint? And what can we tell you about the context around that event and or binary and, everything surrounding it, give us all that information, because it matters when you're tracking attacks, especially long term, trying to connect several dots that don't immediately connect, but might connect after 6, 8, 12 months and on. That's where having that kind of data matters. So, we definitely do, have some capabilities along those lines.
And I'm just wondering, in the last, over the last 6 months or so, have there been any sort of stats that you've dug out of your telemetry that are counterintuitive? Or, it really does seem like it's going back to that same old thing, which is it is kind of business as usual for the malware industry at the moment.
Yeah, we do have some. We recently actually released a threat report that has some stats along the lines of, over 2016, 2017. Here's what we saw as far as certain exploit usage, targeting of certain types of vulnerabilities. We also do have some breakdowns as far as malware families and entry vectors and a few other bits and pieces in there. So we do release some of that information. We do gather a lot of information along those lines. So there's some stuff out there if needed.
Jim Walter, thank you very much for joining us on the show to give us a bit of an update about what's cooking out there in Malwaresville.
Absolutely. Definitely my pleasure.
That was Jim Walter of Silence there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out Silence at CYLANCE.com. Free yourself from the seventh layer of bad AV hell. I think Silence is definitely one that has earned its place on anyone's eval list. So there you go, CYLANCE.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.